I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Congress passed and President Obama signed a $50 billion Sandy relief package earlier this winter to help stricken communities and property owners recover from the October storm that bore down on the East Coast. While accounts of lost and damaged homes are real and heartbreaking, there's a tough question that hangs over what to do in response to natural disasters like Superstorm Sandy. Does it make sense to rebuild in storm-prone areas that have a high risk of being hit once again by another natural disaster? That's referred to as moral hazard. These are policies that end up having the unintended consequence of encouraging risky behavior that costs others. We have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studios. Howard Kunreuther is the James G. Dinan Professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. He's co-director of the Wharton Risk Management and Decision Processes Center, co-author of a brand new book called Insurance and Behavioral Economics, Improving Decisions in the Most Misunderstood Industry. And Howard Kunreuther, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be with you, Marty.
Nice to have you with us. Also with us is Scott Gabriel Knowles. He's an associate professor of history and politics at Drexel University, the director of the Center for Interdisciplinary Inquiry in the Pannoni Honors College. He's also the author of a book called The Disaster Experts, Mastering Risk in Modern America, just out in paperback. And Scott, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
I want to have you take us back. I think we do remember, but I just want to set the stage here for our discussion. Take us back to October when Superstorm Sandy was bearing down on the East Coast. Why was this storm so expensive and so disastrous?
Well, you're right. I mean, this is a storm that claimed 132 American lives, upwards of $80 billion in losses. This is a storm that, although it was predicted pretty effectively, 5 days, even 3 days out, within 70 miles of specificity as to where it would land, it landed in some of the worst. It landed in the worst possible places it could. It landed in places that have a lot of risk, a lot of exposure to storm surge. And then, of course, you know, as it moved up the East Coast and hit New York City, it hit the worst possible places it could have hit in the city, in the Far Rockaways and Staten Island, and then flooding the New York City subway system. So to a certain extent, I would say that Sandy revealed all of the vulnerabilities that are there. Now, these are vulnerabilities that we've known about for quite some time. And I think to a certain extent, we can say that there's really, as horrible as it was, nothing unpredictable about what happened with Sandy. I mean, that's maybe the additional horror, is this, you know, these are risks that are very much obvious and have been obvious for some time. 8 of the 10 worst hurricanes in American history have happened since 2004. And
so we have more storms, more storms that we have to deal with?
Well, we have more storms, but I think the real story here is that we've pretty effectively built ourselves into harm's way. And on the decisions that we've made about how to use land, how to build our infrastructure since World War II, really, but particularly since the 70s and 80s. One example, the population of Ocean County, New Jersey, for example, has gone up 5 times since 1960. The population of Atlantic County has gone up 61%. And you know, the three fastest growing, just to leave the East Coast for a second, the three fastest growing states in the United States since the 1980s have been Florida, California, and Texas. All coastal states and states that have a lot of risk exposure, not only to storms, but also to wildfires and earthquakes. So we're looking at, really, to a certain extent, a storm that was predicted, losses that were, I don't think anybody predicted this level of loss. Perhaps they should have. But this is an environmental crisis. I mean, this is we are really in the middle of, I think, a second environmental crisis in American history, the first one being when we woke up to pollution and toxins in our midst in the 60s and 70s. And this is a second one.
And I do want to get back to that. To you, Howard, and I think Scott did a very good job laying out this really scary scenario. It is also, though, an opportunity, it seems to me, when faced with a disaster of this level, to think and rethink our policies and programs, is it not?
Absolutely, Marty. And I think that is one of the real challenges, to take advantage of the fact that everyone is now paying attention because Sandy hit. It hit in a metropolitan area. It hit where the media is paying attention because New York City was affected. And so there is that opportunity to take steps to avoid the next Superstorm Sandy. And I think that's the challenge we face. How do we do that? Given the fact that people really, really generally say, these disasters are not going to happen to me. But after after a disaster, they will actually feel that it's important to take some steps.
Well, and you use the word myopia in some of your writing. This goes to the, I guess, to the individual, but also maybe to elected officials, which is a kind of blindness after a disaster and things begin to settle down, and then we think we're okay.
We have a very, very small window of opportunity to do things. That's the point, I think, that you're making, that we, right after Sandy, we're going to pay attention. Because it hit the New York City metropolitan area in New Jersey, we will have more time because people are paying more attention, and the storm was a very severe one. But there is a tendency for one to have very short horizons, and the next crisis will then take over. And so politicians and everyone will go back to what it is that they feel has to be dealt with immediately.
Well, and this goes to the $50 billion of Sandy relief that was signed by President Obama. There was a bit of a fight in the House over this, but nonetheless, I think a lot of elected officials, and certainly the ones in New Jersey and New York, put a lot of pressure on other elected officials to come up with this money to help New Jersey and New York.
Well, yes and no. I mean, yes, the bill did get through, but I think we maybe are into some uncharted territory. The vote on that bill was 241 to 180.
Right.
That means 181 people, 179 Republicans and one Democrat, voted against Sandy relief. And, you know, if you look at that a little more closely, 55 of those Republicans who voted against it voted for Katrina relief. The Katrina relief bill in 2005 was voted for 411 against, and it happened in 10 days. This is a bill that took 91 days to materialize, and they were roughly the same amount of money. There's some concern there, I think, that, and maybe we shouldn't be surprised. You know, disasters are political, but this kind of partisanship about disaster relief has now crept into the way that our politics works.
And I don't want to get too lost in Katrina, but do you think some of the lessons of the lack of rebuilding in New Orleans has also raised questions about reconstruction?
I think that's the Republican critique here isn't so much perhaps about the relief funds, but you know, you can sort of break the bill out into two parts. And there's funds for rebuilding infrastructure and for direct assistance to victims and to municipalities. But there's also about $16 billion of it, which is really more for recovery and for economic recovery. And I think there were some scandals and some argument about the way that money was spent post-Katrina. And I think that's what, you know, the nature of the critique from Republicans has been in this instance.
Did you want to add to that, Howard?
Well, I think that one thing that we can say is that clearly, I think at the end of the day, Congress was going to pass a relief bill because of the fact that these areas were so badly hit. But as Scott has said, there's a lot of challenges with respect to the future of disaster relief, and also there's a lot of misunderstanding with respect to what disaster relief is going for. Most of the disaster relief that is coming from these congressional appropriations is to build infrastructure to help the communities get back on its feet. There is some money that is going to residential homes, but I think people really may not fully appreciate how little they will be able to get after disaster. Those, of course, who have suffered losses know this now when they're applying for relief, but the maximum amount that you can get for a home is $31,000 to build it. That is not an awful lot of money if your house has been damaged or destroyed, and it is really not for rebuilding. It's to get it back into some kind of better shape. So there is, I think, a whole set of challenges here with respect to understanding where the disaster relief money is going, and also to understand that there's an opportunity here to possibly rethink the whole system of disaster relief from what we've had in the past.
Help us understand moral hazard. I gave a very short description of it in my introduction. I want a better one from you, if I
well,
could.
I think you're absolutely right in describing the fact that if people are going to be rebuilding in an area, that's a form of moral hazard because of the fact that you now have a site that is developed again and subject to another disaster. So in that sense, there is that action. But moral hazard in the strict definition is a tendency for people to behave more carelessly because they think that they are protected in some form, whether it be by insurance or disaster relief. And that's really not what we see with respect to the history of people behaving in natural disasters and natural hazards. Rather, if I can say,
please,
there's been a tendency for people to say, say it's not going to happen to me, rather than saying that I will be protected if it will happen.
Well, you know, that reminds me of a scene from The World According to Garp, where a plane flies into a house, and he says, "I'll buy that," thinking nothing ever bad could ever happen to this house, and that's why he wants to own it.
The misunderstanding of the concept of the 100-year floodplain, right? That, you know, if you have a flood 1 year, that means you're good for 99 more years. But in fact, and there's a lot of misunderstanding mm-hmm. about the way that risk is calculated, and to this notion of moral hazard. This idea that we hear out there that, to a certain extent, it's kind of the equivalent of what we heard in the 80s about, you know, welfare queens, you know, driving Cadillacs around. There's this idea that there's this sort of group of freeloaders who live on the shore who are, you know, living the high life at everyone else's expense. But that doesn't, I mean, you got to look much closer at the way that the National Flood Insurance Program works and the incentives or disincentives for people to live in these places. Mm-hmm. It's much more complicated than that.
But it seems it's also very psychological. That's what I'm hearing from you, Howard.
I think that's true. There's a book that Danny Kahneman has written called Thinking Fast and Slow that sort of gives an interesting perspective on the fact that we tend, on many of our decisions, to focus on immediate emotions, on things that are really not well thought out. And that works pretty well for many decisions, but when you come to low probability events like natural disasters, right. It doesn't work well at all, because there's a tendency for people to say, "I don't want to think about this. It's not going to happen to me." And the notion of a 1938 hurricane, which Scott knows about very well in his historical kind of treatment of disasters, is something that really could have caused a major amount of damage in New York. It did cause a great deal of damage up in Massachusetts, but people don't even think about those kind of disasters. Mm-hmm. Rather, they say, "This is a nice place to live. I assume it won't happen. I don't want to worry about it." And it's only after the disaster, as you said a moment ago, that people say, "I better pay attention to it." And we do have that opportunity now to take some steps.
Scott, about a minute before our first break here, but I'm thinking of those people that live along the New Jersey shoreline. I know you're not necessarily in the advice business, but for those people thinking about what to do about a property that they own, what should they do looking ahead?
Well, I mean, looking ahead, the conversation has to be about the rules and restrictions on the land use. I think that Governor Christie has said now that it will be state practice to use the FEMA maps in terms of directing how high up these different properties need to be raised. If he actually follows through with that, there can be some very tough decisions around cost in some of these barrier islands particularly. So it's going to come down to decisions of individuals, but I think it's also going to come around, and I hope we'll talk about this more later, too,
sure.
Community decisions. I mean, the idea of land use is not an individual decision in America. We think of, you know, these sort of individual, you know, people out there deciding yes or no to live in these places, but you know, these are places that are developed because, you know, decisions are made at a political level, at a municipal, county, or state level, whether or not these places should be developed. And so I think these people need to be very much involved in the political decisions around zoning, reconstruction.
Yeah.
Hold on to that thought, only because we have to take a very short break. We are talking with Scott Gabriel Knowles and Howard Kunrether, and we are talking about the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy, what to do about reconstruction, and how to think about things like insurance. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Is your child struggling in school? Supporting WHYY, Delaware Valley Friends, a Quaker College preparatory school in Paoli for students who learn differently. Delaware Valley Friends is committed to providing small classes, individual attention, state-of-the-art technology, and an accredited curriculum and faculty for grades 6 through 12. Open house on Wednesday morning, February 27th from 9 to 11 a.m. More information about Delaware Valley Friends at dvfs.org. Registration now open for summer reading and writing program.
We heard from the parents of the unarmed Florida teen whose shooting death last year set off a heated national debate about race, guns, and local laws about self-defense. Now we hear from the brother of the accused. Robert Zimmerman Jr. will be with us next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Yannick Nezet-Séguin and the Philadelphia Orchestra perform Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring, which premiered in Paris a century ago. Tickets at 215-893-1999. This Saturday at 8 p.m. at the Kimmel Center, Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring Centennial, performed in the concert version without any additional visual elements. Also featured Stokowski's Bach orchestrations with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, talking with Howard Kunreuther. He's He's the James G. Dinan Professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, also co-director of the Wharton Risk Management and Decision Processes Center. He's got a new book co-authored with two other writers. It's called Insurance and Behavioral Economics, subtitled Improving Decisions in the Most Misunderstood Industry. Scott Gabriel Knowles, also with us, Associate Professor of History and Politics at Drexel University, and his book, The Disaster Experts, Mastering Risk in Modern America, now out in paperback. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And Howard, we were talking during the break about the role of insurance companies, and your book is subtitled The Most Misunderstood Industry. But help us understand the role of insurance industries, especially when dealing with disasters like Sandy.
No, I'd be happy to. And it follows up on some of the comments that Scott made just a few minutes ago with respect to the challenges that we face. Insurance, when it comes to flood, is not marketed by the private sector. It's a national flood insurance program that has been in existence since 1968. And when it started, very few people were buying it voluntarily, even though it has been, on existing homes, highly subsidized by the federal government. So it's a really good deal on one level, but people basically were behaving as if it wasn't going to happen to them. Tropical Storm Agnes in 1972, which hit Pennsylvania in this area, there was almost no one who had insurance there, even though they could have bought it. And that was 4 years after the program started. And after Hurricane Sandy, less than a third, and in many areas, less than 20% of the people had flood insurance. Many of them were required to have it as a condition for their mortgage and discontinued their coverage.
Are you allowed to do that?
Well, they're not allowed to do that according to regulations, but they did. For whatever reason, the banks didn't enforce the regulation, and many people who bought it right afterwards felt it was not a good deal because they hadn't suffered any losses and they were putting in premiums and getting nothing back. And one of the hardest things with respect to insurance, and one of the reasons it's misunderstood, is that the best return on an insurance policy is no return at all. You should celebrate you haven't had a loss and your premium isn't wasted because it may be needed in the future, and therefore that's one of the things one has to work with. Now, if I could say a word about the flood insurance program today,
sure.
A piece of legislation was passed in July of this year before Hurricane Sandy, which has really modified the program and will modify the program, because instead of having premiums that are highly subsidized, there is really a direction to have premiums that are risk-based, that reflect the risk. And that has a set of challenges as well as opportunities.
Well, I want to pick up on that, but let me go back to you, Scott, because I know you have looked at communities, the community response to a natural disaster. And I'm thinking about all those communities hit hard by Sandy that pulled together, they helped each other. I mean, in certain ways, we saw some pretty inspiring behavior.
Some extraordinary stories of communities coming together. And we were talking the other night about at an event we had about disaster here in town, about the images of paramedics and nurses carrying babies down 9 floors at the Langone Medical Center. I mean, every disaster gives us these extraordinary moments of humanity and compassion, and I think we shouldn't lose sight of that. Communities do pull together, but I think often there's this concern then about, well, what do we do next?
Exactly.
And, in New Jersey, this is particularly difficult because, there's been an ethos of rapid coastal development. It's the most heavily, densely populated coastline in the United States. 60% of the state lives in coastal counties. The push has been from the real estate, construction, banking complex to develop. And I think people have have bought into that. And now the question is, they're saying, well, maybe we shouldn't have been in these places. And I think it comes down to this question, this larger issue we're talking about, sustainability. As we're rebuilding, we're thinking about rebuilding, will we be able to withstand another storm, or should we have to withstand another storm? But that comes back to difficult questions about whole communities moving, people retreating from the coastline, at least in the most dangerous places.
And let me just add something else to that, which is that a sea level rise, which is now measurable. So it's not, we're talking about not an abstraction, but literal sea level rise.
It is, and there was a 2005 report out of Princeton that really kind of, I think, shook up people in the environmental protection community in New Jersey, where it really sort of mapped and projected the sea level rise in the state. And the sea level rise in the Atlantic coast is going, it's rising there faster than other parts of the world. So this is not an abstraction. This is something we'll be facing in real time. And so now what you've done is you've pitted two interests against each other. One is the interest of the state in terms of fostering development, right, which is an
tourism,
important function,
right?
The $16 billion tourism industry in the coastal New Jersey. The other is the function of the state to protect citizens. And when they come into conflict, we hope it can work itself out. But as it works itself out through a democratic process, there's going to be winners and losers.
I wonder, too, Howard, whether the insurance industry will end up doing what perhaps elected officials can't or won't do, which is, in a sense, forcing behavior through premiums and the cost of premiums.
Well, I think that is the real challenge and opportunity. And let me just indicate, before I answer your question, just say a word about what Scott was saying with respect to and your question on communities. I think there is a tremendous opportunity for communities to raise a set of questions when they've had a disaster to rethink it. A group of us were involved in a study by the National Academy of Sciences on resiliency to natural disasters, and we visited several communities, and one of them was Cedar Rapids, Iowa, that had a major flood in 2008. And in the process of that flood, the community pulled together and said, how are we going to actually rebuild? How are we going to put in new land use regulations, building codes? How do we get the public involved? That is a real challenge for obviously all the communities and the New Jersey communities that are affected by this. Can they take advantage of this to ask those questions in the future? And the insurance industry certainly can play a role, or in this particular case, the National Flood Insurance Program. And you're absolutely right that premiums, if they are sort of set as to reflect risk, can do a couple of things that are very important. First, if you do have a premium that reflects risk, you will know how hazardous an area is. And if all of a sudden your premium is going up now five times, that will tell you this is a much more dangerous area than what the flood insurance premiums were set. And they are set by the government, so it's not a profit-making organization. They're trying to do things to reflect risk. The second thing that the premium can do is it can encourage you to mitigate and to adapt your house. So if you build a better house, if you elevate your house, if you move it to a better location, that is less fraud prone, you will get a premium discount, which you would not have gotten if the premium was subsidized, but now that it's reflecting risk. But there are challenges of affordability, and we can get into that at some point, either now or later.
Well, in fact, that was a question I had, which is all that makes sense, but that means that people that have more money then can afford to do this mitigation, Scott.
Well, I think that is a real concern. I mean, particularly looking at, the cost of, if we do make these adjustments to the way the flood insurance program works and allow actually the premiums to reflect risk, then rates are going to go up in some areas. There's no doubt
about
it.
Because these are risky areas to live.
That's right. Now, maybe the long-term answer to that, to a certain extent, is that the more people who are covered by insurance, I mean, there's almost sort of a healthcare analogy here. The more people you get into the pool, as Howard said, in the Northeast, if there's 15-20% of people in risky areas who have flood insurance, the more people you get in, then potentially the idea is that you could manage the costs, and that will have a stabilizing effect on the cost. I think there are other things, and Howard has written about this, in terms of offering vouchers and perhaps means testing for individuals who may need some help as they're making an adjustment over time. I think you can also offer tax incentives to get people to, as you mentioned, as Howard mentioned, mitigation techniques for your home. And those can be the most outstanding ones are to have to move your home, right, or to raise your home. But there are other things that people can do to make their homes more resilient or to make them less prone to disasters.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. Hold on to that thought. That's Scott Gabriel Knowles from Drexel University. Also with us, Howard Kunreuther from the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Howard, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to elaborate on the points that Scott was making, because I think they are very important ones, and we discuss them in more detail in our book and in other work that we've done at the Risk Center. If you think about insurance, when the rates reflect risk, it does cause these problems with respect to whether people can afford it or not. And so we have felt that it's extremely important not only to have a principle that premiums reflect risk, which is what we talked about, but there has to be a principle of equity and affordability. And that has to be very explicitly stated, and particularly when we're dealing with people who are currently residing in these hazard-prone areas. Because any low-income person in New Jersey, New York, and hit by Sandy is going to immediately say, as I'm sure many of your listeners will be saying as they're listening to us, can I afford this? Is that this premium is much too high, and I want to live in this area. And so the idea that Scott alluded to about insurance vouchers, like food stamps are vouchers for people who need special treatment, whatever that might be. It could be on a whole variety of levels, including people who are working in the area who are needed for there. You have giving them some type of a voucher that actually enables them to buy this insurance now that the premium has gone up. They still will get a premium discount if they mitigate. It doesn't take away, and they'll also know what the rate and the premium is, so they realize how hazardous it is. But you will have to help them in some fashion to make this both politically feasible and affordable for the people there.
Going back to something you said earlier, though, that something like a third of people affected by Sandy had some kind of health insurance, and you've also written that looking at individual behavior, about half people cancel their flood insurance after a few years. And I keep thinking about car insurance, where people are pretty much required to have car insurance, and it seems like there's a system that largely works. Are there some lessons from car insurance we can apply to flood insurance?
Well, I think there are lessons from both car insurance and, frankly, homeowners insurance. Homeowners insurance is marketed by the private sector. Banks clearly enforce that in ways that they haven't enforced it with flood insurance. So we do have a good model, even on homeowners insurance. I think one of the problems is that it, because of the fact that often these mortgages may get parceled out to other areas, secondary areas, that aren't even aware of the flood problem with respect to where the insurance is originally marketed, there doesn't seem to be the whole mechanism in place right now for enforcing it, because we do have these lessons, as you said, both for car and homeowners, that these are enforced.
Scott, anything you want to add to that? I do want to get to our callers, but any thoughts you have? No? No? You're good?
I was just going to say that I think it is there's another element to this. We're talking about insurance, too, which is that the mapping of the floodplains and the availability of the maps has been a really key issue here. I mean, the way that the flood insurance program was created, it was created to bring down the need for disaster relief after the disaster had occurred. I mean, this is a compensation mechanism to try to get people to think ahead of the risks that they're facing. But there are a couple important things. One is that people who live in risky areas were meant to actually buy it. And also, there was a very elaborate sort of requirement of mapping here, which and that's to a certain extent, or from a science perspective, that's kind of exhilarating stuff, and we're going to map our coastline and keep an up-to-date kind of registry of the risks that we face, because these hazards shift just as our coastline shifts. Problem from the perspectives of municipalities, counties, or individuals as they're making land use decisions or buying property is that if the maps are out of date, they're flying blind in terms of knowing whether or not they're in a safe area or not. And I think there are a lot of stories of people who all of a sudden realize they've been zoned into a floodplain without realizing it, and now they have to make a decision about, do I sell this house? Do I buy more insurance? So just briefly, Howard mentioned this Biggert Waters bill, the reform bill that was passed over the last summer, and one of the things it stipulates is a greater commitment to keeping these maps updated, and that's a very clear role for the state here and state departments of environmental protection to really participate in that and make that information available.
Go ahead, Howard, and then we'll get to our
colleagues. I think that one of the challenges we face, just building on what Scott has said, is that FEMA is very, very concerned with making sure their maps are accurate for just the reasons that he mentioned. If you're going to set insurance premiums reflecting risk, you have to have good maps. Now, this is a challenge today to get these finished quickly, and in fact, the whole rebuilding process, both in New Jersey and New York, and there's a whole set of activities going on in New York City as we speak on better maps, is going to require a better flood map by FEMA, and FEMA is now doing this and releasing these maps in the next week or so, so that people can rebuild. But we also have to take into account what climate change is going to do to these maps and how they will actually be structured. So this is a mammoth task, and the bill that was passed in July, as Scott mentioned, is authorizing them. But unless we have these maps, insurance doesn't have a lot of meaning, because you won't be able to really say how do these premiums reflect risk.
And because we're on the cusp of sequester and government right. debates about funding, you might have a law that says you need these maps, but do you have the people and the wherewithal to create them, Scott?
Well, I think that speaks to some changes that maybe we should be looking for at FEMA. FEMA is an agency that is now in a mega agency. It's sort of tucked away in the Department of Homeland Security, and that's only been the case since 2002. Now, FEMA's mission from 2002, certainly up to Katrina, was really focused. I mean, they had to take on their natural disaster mission, but they had to take on a counterterrorism mission as well. And I think Katrina really was the first test of that philosophy, and I think it failed. After Katrina, there was reform bill passed to try to give FEMA a little bit more autonomy within DHS. But I think there's a lot of concern. I have a lot of concern, and others do, about the budgeting level for FEMA. I mean, this is an agency, again, it's competing for resources within the Department of Homeland Security. I think the most recent budget for mapping, in last year's budget, was around $100 million. FEMA needs to be able to argue for the importance of this function, and they need support. Again, you sort of back to this question of what can citizens do. We're in the weeds of bureaucracy here, but one of the things citizens, I think, can do is demand to have a federal bureaucracy that works and that serves their interests as they're trying to make these decisions about where to live. We talk a lot about disaster relief, but we also need to be talking about disaster mitigation, and FEMA can lead the way there.
Howard, is there insurance myopia? We talked a bit about, you know, individual myopia on dealing with disasters and floods. Is there insurance myopia?
Insurance myopia in the sense that, say a little bit more.
Well,
what you
just
mean.
That there's a kind of a sense of denial, or perhaps not understanding its responsibility to provide the insurance.
Well, there's no question that people do not understand insurance, and there is myopia in the following sense. If something hasn't happened for a while, I don't want insurance. It's viewed as a poor investment. I've wasted my premiums, and so therefore I don't want to take it. If I don't think the disaster is going to happen to me, then I'm not going to buy it, because it's off my radar screen and there's no reason to buy it. And that's one of the reasons why insurance is often required, because if it isn't required, it would be very, very unlikely that a lot of people would have some of that of the insurance, because they feel really it isn't necessary. So in that sense, there's my
But do you think there's miscalculation on the part of the insurance company as well, that they don't understand risk, and we're almost up in a break here?
Insurance companies have also faced challenges, and I think an example that we could use is with terrorism coverage. The insurance industry did not charge a penny for terrorism insurance prior to 9/11. Even though you had the World Trade Center disaster and Oklahoma City, they felt it was below a level of their concern, and therefore they put it in as a part of the coverage without actually separating it out. And after 9/11, they refused to offer coverage, and therefore we had a terrorism Risk Insurance Act. That isn't exactly what one considers rational behavior or well thought out. And so the insurance industry has a set of questions that mirror what we see in the way of people who are in harm's way.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation and our callers at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Resident Ensemble Players, Delaware's professional acting company in residence at the University of Delaware, supports WHYY. The REP offers the work and words of master storytellers and presents Hamlet, February 28th through March 17th. Murder, melancholy, and madness rock this powerful production of Shakespeare's tragedy, staged by Broadway's Tony Award-nominated director Mark Lamos. For tickets, 302-831-2204 or DelawareRep.org. I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll look at a case before the Supreme Court challenging the Voting Rights Act. Some states say they've overcome roadblocks to voting. The Obama administration says they've created new roadblocks. Also, farmers in Kansas and Oklahoma hoping all that snow means an end to the drought. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
The Fleischer Art Memorial proudly supports WHYY and has a 115-year tradition of providing art classes for thousands of children and adults throughout the Delaware Valley. There are workshops in drawing, painting, sculpting, and more taught by Fleischer's noted faculty. The Fleischer Art Memorial spring term begins April 6th and offers more than 60 art workshops. Registration and more information is available online at fleischer.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. And if you're just joining us, as we know, property owners and beach communities in New Jersey are hoping to repair the damage of Superstorm Sandy before the start of the summer season. The state, of course, depends on tourism, and that shoreline is a hot property when it comes to tourism and people going there for the beach and for the for a vacation. So reconstruction has become a top priority in New Jersey after a vigorous debate in the U.S. House. President Obama signed a $50 billion Sandy relief measure into law last month, and some of that money is directed to storm victims and areas in New Jersey hit hard by Superstorm Sandy. We are talking about whether it makes sense to rebuild in storm and flood-prone areas that could become a natural disaster again. And again, our guests are Scott Gabriel Knowles. He's an associate professor of history and politics at Drexel University. His book, The Disaster Experts, Mastering Risk in Modern America, now out in paperback. Howard Kunreuther, co-director of the Wharton Risk Management and Decision Processes Center. He's the co-author of a brand new book called Insurance and Behavioral Economics, Improving Decisions in the Most Misunderstood Industry. And we want to hear from you, especially if you live along the New Jersey shore. If you have property that has been affected by Sandy, we want to know what you think of our conversation. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Scott, you wanted to add something to what Howard said, then we'll get to our callers.
Well, we were talking about the insurance industry and, you know, whether or not we should be expecting more of the industry. And I think, I'm going to sound like a historian here, history helps potentially
nothing
here.
Nothing wrong with that.
You know, in my book, I write about, you know, the problem. You know, cities faced an existential crisis in the late 19th and early 20th century because there were conflagrations that were burning down whole cities, right? Boston, Chicago, Baltimore, stories we heard about, they're sort of stories of lore. Most people don't think about how that problem was solved. They just sort of assume government kind of solved it. And government kind of did, but in fact, it was the insurance industry, the fire insurance industry. They really realized they were going to go out of business if they didn't come up with a way to put some really serious pressure on government to adopt things like zoning, building codes, and new material standards. And there's an interesting thing that came out of it, which actually shapes the way we live today, which was private regulation. So we don't have a national building code in the United States. Again, land use policies and building is very local, but there are organizations like Underwriters Laboratories, you know, the little UL symbol that you see on your light bulbs and on your computer. That's a nonprofit, private regulatory group, basically, that the fire insurance industry helped create that sets standards. And that's a very creative response to a problem where you didn't have government able to solve the problem. Citizens weren't able to solve the problem. And the insurance industry was highly creative here, but they were incentivized because there was nobody bailing them out. They had to make this adjustment in order for cities to thrive. But the problem was solved in that instance.
Well, it's interesting. Go ahead, Howard.
The only point I'd want to make is that we have exactly that kind of system in operation today with the hope that this will actually do what Scott was saying in the past. We have an Institute for Business, Home, and Safety, which is an institute that is supported by the insurance industry and other sources to do exactly the point that Scott is making. How do we do a better job of mitigating our losses from natural disasters, not just floods and hurricanes, earthquakes, tornadoes? And the whole idea is to really have the insurance industry working closely with the notion, not only with this institute, but with state and local communities to really figure out the appropriate building codes, how they will get enforced, and at the same time give the appropriate incentives to individuals, which is what premiums can do, for them to take the steps to improve their homes.
Let's see what Chris from Tuckerton has to say. And Chris, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello. Yes. I live in Southern Ocean County. Excuse me.
Sure.
And the last time that a storm like this comparable was in 1962, which was beyond my lifetime, 50 years ago.
Sure.
And I would think, you know, the money would be there after people paying into it for 50 years, where the people that are now paying into it should be taken care of. You know, I wondered where that money went.
Well, and you're talking about people paying into private insurance, Chris?
Yes, the people have been paying flood insurance. I would think after 50 years, the money would be there.
Oh, okay. Yeah, go ahead, Howard.
Well, I think one of the problems, Chris, in terms of what has happened is that we've had some very, very severe flooding. Katrina caused an enormous amount of flooding and damage from storm surge, and Hurricane Sandy did that as well. And the premiums up until now have been highly subsidized. So the money has been there in the sense that premiums come in, but the expenditures in terms of how to rebuild have been very, very severe. And one of the reasons we had this new legislation that was passed was simply in order to be able to try to make the program more solvent in the future. And that's why we're talking about the notion of premiums reflecting risk, which they haven't up until now, but it does cause the challenges with respect to some of the affordability issues we talked about.
Yeah, Chris, thanks for the call to Radio Times. But Scott, I think it's always, perhaps it's just become a more recent pattern. If there's a disaster, who are you going to call? You're going to call the government. I mean, it seems like that is the response, whether it's been encouraged or whether for political reasons, that's what people expect the government to do.
Well, I mean, it goes back to the founding of the country. I mean, we have congressional disaster relief going back to the first 10 years of the 19th century. And it was the thing is, it was always done sort of bill by bill, disaster by disaster, up until really in the 1970s. And then disaster declarations, presidential disaster declarations, really sort of began to skyrocket. Have under 200 in the 60s. We have over 500 in the 2000s disaster declarations. And so, yeah, it's become a much more present part of our lives and thinking about, and there are incentives for politicians to offer relief. Unfortunately, those same incentives don't seem to carry over into political will to require mitigation or to do the kind of things Howard was talking about to make sure that risks, the premiums reflect risk with flood insurance. That's there. That program should work that way. The fact that it hasn't puts Chris in a tough position because he'd been playing by the rules, and now he's told that the program wasn't working the way it was supposed to.
Chris, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's see what Joe from Mystic Island has to say. And Joe, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi.
Our area was hit pretty hard. Probably about 600 homes were severely damaged. And the FEMA maps are now telling us that we're going from an A zone to a V zone.
Wow.
And I understand there's some money that's available for mitigating to raise the houses up, but it's not nearly enough. And even after the houses are raised in the V zone, the insurance is going to be prohibitive for most people that are... It's a middle-class area. I mean, it's not a... They're not wealthy people that are having the homes rented out for the summer. It's most people are, it's families that are living there.
Sure.
So I don't see how the community can survive this.
Well,
Christy has made these maps to instead of being preliminary maps, they're now supposedly that's going to be the law of the land. So I don't understand how we're going to survive.
Joe, let me just ask you one question. So tell me where Mystic Island is. What part of New Jersey are we talking about?
It's on the mainland. It's in the southern part of Ocean County.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you called because I'll toss that first to you, Howard.
Well, I think, Joe, this is the real challenge that everyone is facing right now. When you reclassify an area into from an A zone to a V zone, and you now see that the risk is somewhat higher because the maps have now said that, and people are going to say, I cannot afford this insurance, one has to be able to deal with that. Now, the new flood insurance bill is addressing that very directly by authorizing a study to deal with means-tested values. Vouchers and ways that one could somehow help people afford these premiums, because if you don't do that, we're going to be running into exactly what you face. And I think there's a great deal of sympathy and understanding for that, but also a need to try to figure out what kind of a system we should have in place to address the point that you're raising.
Yeah, Joe, let me give Scott a chance to weigh in as well. And Scott, you began the show by talking about how many people now live in these coastal areas, whether it's New Jersey or along the East or West Coast or even parts of Texas.
That's right. And I think, there's sort of two kinds of coastal risk. I mean, we tend to focus only on the people who have, you know, multimillion-dollar homes right on the shorefront, maybe less on, you know, the kind of communities that Joe's mm-hmm. describing. You know, the fact is that these decisions are political decisions. You know, the recommendations can be made by FEMA, the recommendations can be made by scientists, but at the end of the day, land use decisions are political. And I think to accept the idea that, you know, development is a sort of fait accompli isn't right. So I think, again, communities need to be, you know, community members are going to have to sit down and talk about, as they go forward from here, what should and shouldn't be developed. Now, the situation that Joe finds himself in is one where I think political advocacy is important, too. You know, Governor Christie can say this is the way we're going to go, but, you know, it hasn't been implemented yet.
Though,
right? It has consequences, and, you know, it can have political consequences for a governor who does want to be reelected and has larger political ambitions. So I wouldn't tell any community to despair that anything is written in stone yet.
Joe, thanks for the call to Radio Times. One of the other arguments, and because we're still dealing with the recession, is that construction and jobs affiliated with what we've been talking about, Howard.
Yeah, well, I think that's exactly right. I mean, there's a whole issue of employment. There's a whole issue of rebuilding, and construction will take place. I mean, there are some silver linings to natural disasters in the sense that employment will increase in the construction industry, et cetera. But I think there's also an opportunity here, and building on what Scott said a moment ago in terms of communities playing a role, this might be an opportunity for Joe and for others living in communities to really advocate. Are there things that communities can do to make their community safer? It would increase property values, number one, if you can mitigate and have the home safer. And at the same time, it will reduce the premiums that one will have to pay, which is, of course, the concern of everyone.
Sure.
So making a safer home will have a lower insurance premium, whether you live in an A zone or a V zone.
Scott.
Add to that very briefly, and people ask, you know, what kind of things can communities do? You know, studies are going on around the country, again, talking about climate change adaptation. And there are a lot of techniques. I mean, we tend to think of sort of hard infrastructure, and people can lobby for that kind of thing. So seawalls, levees, things like that. But there are other kinds of infrastructures like dunes, extending beach widths, and the development of wetlands. I mean, you know, we look, you know, the environmental community, the planning community, architects, engineers are showing us a lot of what's possible out there now. But again, it's going to take citizen action. And if citizens don't take action, others are going to take action for them.
Well, and it needs to be sustained as well. I mean, there is this, you know, initial response to a disaster, but in 2 years, our community is going to be talking about mitigation.
In maybe 1 year.
Or maybe, based on some of your research, right?
Well, I think this is, you know, I said this notion of an environmental crisis. I mean, we didn't solve the problem of fire in cities after one fire. That, I agree with Howard, that is, you know, the window of change is opened after these disasters, but this is a much longer-term process.
Right.
This is a system that we've built now, a system of people living in harm's way, and it took us two generations to get into it. We're not going to solve it after one storm, but we have to begin to make changes now.
If I could say, one of the things that we have been advocating, and we're hoping the flood program will move in this direction, is to have multi-year insurance policies. Right now, we have annual policies, so people can cancel it after a year, and many, as you said, do that. Have multi-year policies tied to the property, not to the individuals, and the flood program can do that because it's the only game in town. It's the only insurance that marketed, and so another person moves in, they could take over the policy. Have a home improvement loan that actually spreads the cost of mitigation over a long period of time, over 20 or 30 years, and if you do that, people can mitigate, make their home safer. The cost of the loan will be actually less than the insurance premium reduction. Mm-hmm. So it's a good deal economically for people if you have this long-term loan, and as a result, people will have an economic incentive to do that. They don't do it today, and one of the reasons they don't do it is it's the very high upfront cost that they have to pay. They say it isn't worth it, but let's spread this over time.
Let's see what Bill from Ship Bottom has to say. Bill, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hi. I own a secondary home, a vacation home in Long Beach Island in Ship Bottom. I helped mitigate the potential of loss on my property by raising my house up 7 or 8 years ago. And now we've had Hurricane Sandy. I've had adjusters out to my house for both my flood and my homeowners. and both of them have pushed through settlements. I received checks in the mail with no documentation whatsoever from the adjusting company, and therefore thousands and thousands of dollars less than what my losses are, with no documentation. And now I have to appeal both of these decisions, and most of my neighbors down there are doing the same thing. The insurance companies seem to be, in my estimation, scamming everybody and just throwing checks out there and hoping people will accept settlements.
Well, Bill, let me see what Howard has to say. Go ahead, Howard.
Well, Bill, that should not happen. Let's say that straight out. One should have documentation as to why you got the claim you got and the rationale for it. And so you have every right to sort of be concerned about that. I'm not exactly sure why that has occurred and whether because of the large number of claims these things are being sent out that way. But it is exactly the kind of thing that should be stopped immediately, because this is exactly why people will be concerned that they're not getting fairly treated. So the fact that you're doing this and mentioning it here on the air is an important point. Any insurance company would provide you with the rationale for a claim, and I would expect that you should get the same kind of treatment from the National Flood Insurance Program.
Bill, thanks for the call to Radio Time. Scott, we're almost out of time here, but do you think we'll be back in 10 years having the same conversation, or are we in a learning curve, and perhaps nature is forcing us to learn some things, hard lessons?
I'm afraid that we are going to continue to see everything we talked about, with climate change and sea level rise and the amount of exposure that we have in the American coast, 100 million people living in coastal zones in the United States. And we can't retreat from these places, right? So I think if we have three choices, mitigation or compensation or retreat, we've got to focus on the first two. Mm-hmm. We may be here 10 years from now having this conversation. The hope, though, is that by then, some of these things we talked about, reforming FEMA, reforming the flood insurance program, and actually getting citizens involved in land use decisions, that will have tamped down some of the losses.
Very quickly, Howard. You have 10 seconds.
Yeah, 10 seconds. I'm a little more optimistic than Scott, although I agree with him. I think there's a real opportunity for the Obama administration, with the kind of Congress that wants to try to do some things in a more efficient way, to do something better than we've done. And the hope is we'll do this over the next 2 or 3 years, but we'll wait and see.
We will indeed. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Howard Kunrither from the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, co-author of a new book, Insurance and Behavioral Economics, Improving Decisions in the Most Misunderstood Industry. Scott Gabriel Knowles from Drexel University and his book, The Disaster Experts, Mastering Risk in Modern America, now out in paperback. My thanks to both of you. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program, and stay with us. We'll be right back.